Okay, just to be clear on our plan for this, we do plan to begin in the open. We expect there will be classified material that both sides will want to discuss, so we'll break when that time comes. So if you want to begin your the arguments on both sides with only material that you are confident is not classified, we'll do it that way and save the other arguments for the classified session.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if in the course of this discussion there are things you want to say, there's more, but it's in the classified session, say that so we have some signing that there's something else to come.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Dana Karasvang representing the government in this case. As we argued in our brief, the district court applied wrong legal standards to determine whether Uthman was part of Al-Qaeda, and remand is required for that reason. We also argue that the evidence here is enough for this court to reverse the district court outright. But I'd like to start with the legal error. The district court here decided this case before this court clarified the legal standard for part of Al-Qaeda in Bensaya and Awad and other cases. And it granted the petition because it found the government had not demonstrated that Uthman received and executed orders from Al-Qaeda. Since that time, this court has repeatedly held that evidence that a person received and executed orders from Al-Qaeda is sufficient to show that he's part of Al-Qaeda, but it is not required. Bensaya requires a functional analysis, and the real issue is whether there are indicia that the individual is sufficiently involved with the organization to be deemed a part of it. This court recognized that evidence of close associations with Al-Qaeda members, as in Al-Adahi and Salahi, and other evidence that shows somebody is integrated into the group of Al-Qaeda fighters, for example, movement with the group in Al-Oda, being with the group at a critical time in Awad. This kind of evidence can show that somebody is part of Al-Qaeda. The district court dismissed this evidence in this case as associational evidence, failed to show that it understood the legal standard, said that it was applying this received and executed orders test. And as in Salahi, it treated the absence of evidence that Uthman received and executed orders to be dispositive. And so its decision, as this court said in Salahi, cannot survive Awad and Bensaya, which is why at a minimum, remand is necessary here.
Are you aware of an instance where we have denied a habeas position petition based solely on circumstantial evidence? Any instances where that's happened yet? I know we're developing a new body of law here, but
well, I guess it depends on what we're thinking of as circumstantial evidence. In Al-Adahi, this court emphasized the need to look at the evidence as a whole, to put together the whole chain, the fact that Al-Adahi knew Al-Qaeda members, had these relationships, traveled along the route, used by terrorists, attended this training camp. In Awad, we have somebody who traveled to Afghanistan to fight jihad, but then says he was never able to do that until he ends up behind the barricade with Al-Qaeda fighters at a hospital when he is very sick, and that was evidence that he was part of Al-Qaeda.
But we have, so in this case, cases, we have instances where, you know, someone's carrying an AK-47, where they acknowledge that they're on their way for jihad. We don't have anything quite like this here. We have denials from the detainee and circumstantial evidence. This seems different to me.
Well, the evidence, just to be clear, of course, we don't need to get into that if Your Honors decide to remand this case. But if you decide to deny the writ outright, remember, one of the pieces of evidence here is that Uthman was with this group of Al-Qaeda fighters in the vicinity of Tora Bora after the battle there.
Is that alone enough?
I don't know if that would be alone enough, but that's not this case.
How close was it, you say, in the vicinity of? Do we know?
We don't know exactly where he was Uthman and I believe at least three of the people with Uthman all said that they were captured on the border crossing from Afghanistan into Pakistan. We also have Uthman's statements that he walked for 8 days through the mountains in difficult terrain and harsh weather, which would put him in those Tora Bora Mountains.
You know what? Could you compare his path on the way out to the path in Al Oda, which we said was evidence? I would describe it as taking the long way home. Is this the same path or a different path?
We don't have all of the details about the path, but just as in Al Oda, he was with a group of Al-Qaeda fighters in the mountains around Tora Bora and crossed or attempted to cross from there into Pakistan. So this does seem to be the same path as in Al Oda. And also, he came to Afghanistan along the path used by Al-Qaeda fighters in a trip that was paid for by Sheikh Al-Wadi. He lied to hide that fact.
That's disputed, right? That's very much in dispute.
Well, it's not. The district court found that the travel was paid for by Sheikh Al-Wadi. He submitted in his sworn declaration in the district court that the travel was not paid for by Sheikh Al-Wadi, that he actually saved the $1,200 he needed for this trip himself, working summer jobs, selling fruit and fish at a roadside stand and teaching Quran, which I think was pretty unbelievable since the average income in Yemen at that time was $280 to $380 a year. So he also repeatedly said prior to his sworn declaration that he got the money for his trip from Sheikh Al-Wadi. The thing that was disputed is whether Sheikh Al-Wadi supports jihad. And the government submitted a number of statements supporting that Sheikh Al-Wadi supports jihad, including people who were captured with Uthman, who went to school with Uthman, who said that Sheikh Al-Wadi had given them their fatwa and paid for their travel, one of whom later admitted to being a bodyguard for Osama bin Laden. So that was actually the dispute. Captured with that person, yes. And so there's no question under the district court's findings that Uthman did lie in his declaration when he said that Sheikh Al-Wadi had not paid for his travel. And of course, under Al-Adahi, that kind of evidence is, that kind of false exculpatory statement is evidence, often strong evidence, that an individual is part of Al-Qaeda. And of course, another one of the district court's legal errors in this case was failing to treat that evidence as evidence that Uthman was part of Al-Qaeda.
You made that argument, but in footnote 26 of the district court opinion, I thought the judge was pretty careful to say that he weighed all the false and contradictory statements and just didn't find them as persuasive as you would want them to.
Well, Your Honor, at that point, he is only considering whether or not this story of Uthman's that he taught Quran, even though he didn't speak the language of his students, is what way to give that. But he never acknowledges in the opinion, the district court never acknowledges in the opinion that Uthman, his finding that Sheikh Al-Wadi paid for Uthman's travel means that Uthman lied when he said that he paid for his travel himself, and that that is itself evidence that Uthman was part of Al-Qaeda. The district court also doesn't talk about Uthman's story about travel, that instead of leaving Afghanistan after September 11th, when 4,000 people a day are fleeing over the border, over the Khyber Pass, Uthman instead stays in Kabul until, even after the Allies start bombing, until after the Allied forces take control of the city, and that's when he flees for his safety. And then he flees towards coast and then into the Tora Bora Mountains, which is the path that the Al-Qaeda fighters were taking for this last stand against the United States and Allied forces, and is also...
But am I right that we only have him near the Tora Bora Mountains? Do we ever have him in there?
Well, he says that he walked through the mountains, difficult terrain, harsh weather. This was winter. So he says that he was in these mountains. And, of course, one of the people that he was captured with, that he says he knows, that he, in fact, went to school with in Yemen at the school where al-Qaeda recruiters were operating, said that this was a group of brothers retreating from Tora Bora and other positions on the front lines. So we do think that the evidence here strongly supports the conclusion that Uthman was...
Some of this is evidence that the district court made findings about, and some of it is evidence that the district court did not address. Is that right?
Your Honor, the district court found that Uthman traveled to school where al-Qaeda recruited, that he was captured with al-Qaeda members in the vicinity of Tora Bora after the battle there, that he traveled to Afghanistan along the route taken by al-Qaeda fighters, that Sheikh al-Wadi paid for his travel, that he was seen at two al-Qaeda guest houses, at least one. We can talk about that more in the classified session if necessary, and that he submitted this not entirely believable cover story about teaching students whose language he didn't speak. The district court didn't mention the fact that, as in Al-Oda, Uthman also couldn't provide the names of his students or say where his school was, that he says he lived next door to and taught at that school for 10 months. So we do think the evidence is...
Well, if I compare the five factors listed in the district court's unclassified opinion, part of the problem here from my point of view anyway is that the district court's classified and unclassified opinion look completely different. Page different, footnote different, and large segments of the classified part are not in the unclassified part, and you can't tell where, so you have to bear with me on this. He lists five items on which he gave credence, right? That's at page J256. You, in your brief, I believe in both the classified and unclassified, although all the detail isn't in the unclassified, list eight items. This is on page 28 of your reply brief.
Yes, Your Honor.
So I take it your position is you have, in addition to the five items that you think are sufficient, the district court did not think you have a number of other items, all of which have more evidence about them. Is that right?
Your Honor, on that list, yeah. Item number six,
yes,
was that he went into the mountains in the vicinity of Tora Bora during al-Qaeda's last stand there.
Yes.
Now, the district court did find that this was the well-known site of Uthman's last stand.
Not Uthman's last stand.
Of al-Qaeda's last stand. I believe that is...
Footnote 11.
Footnote 11, exactly. And Uthman's own declaration said that he went into the mountains.
All I'm saying... No, I got that. But all I'm saying is in the court's conclusion where he lists the facts that he's finding, he doesn't list that one.
He does not list that, but he makes that finding in footnote 11. And, of course, going into the mountains is from Uthman's declaration, so we view that to be uncontested evidence. Item 5 we would need to discuss in closed session. And
Item 5 you're talking about of your list.
Of my list, yes, Your Honor. So we do think that these are the district court's factual findings or supported by uncontested evidence, and they do... require this court to find that Uthman was part of al-Qaeda and deny the writ outright. But even if you disagree with me as to that, of course, here the district court applied the wrong legal standard, and at a minimum, under Salahi, a remand is required. If there are no further questions,
I think the standard for detention should be the same today as it would be if this hearing had been held in January of 2002?
Well, Your Honor, the standard is part of al-Qaeda. This court has explained over time what that means.
In other words, should there be a higher showing, though, to hold someone 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years?
Your Honor, that's
the same standard.
question here, we're just trying to apply the law as this court has given it to us, which is to look at whether the individual is sufficiently integrated into Al-Qaeda to be considered part of it.
Part of the problem, of course, is because when you think about detaining someone just for a ordinary war, the standard would be lower than thinking about detaining someone for 50 years, and we're trying to...
May I confer with my co-counsel?
Sure.
Your Honor, this is an ongoing conflict right now. So certainly right now, it is clear that we can hold these individuals under the laws of war and under the authorization of the AUMF. Of course, the executive separately has a review process where it looks at whether individuals present an ongoing threat. But that does not inform the analysis done in this court and in the district court as to whether the individual is part of Al-Qaeda. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time, or
not. Well, that certainly gives us a choice. we'll see how this goes.
Morning, Your Honors. I am Anthony Phillips, counsel for Petitioner Uthman Abdul Rahim Muhammad Uthman, the appellee. Your Honors, this is not a close case. All of the major allegations the government made at the district court were resolved at the district court level and have been abandoned by the government at this stage here. What's left, the evidence with which the government would like to detain Uthman for who knows how long, are the tattered remnants of the arguments that were made at the district court level.
Just because they had really strong arguments that they're not now yet not using doesn't mean the ones that are left are not pretty strong.
Well,
so the real question is, at least the starting question is, didn't the district court use the wrong test?
It did not, Your Honor. It's clear from the plain language of the district court opinion that it did not require the government to make a showing that Petitioner Uthman received and executed orders.
Let's just focus on the text of the district court's opinion and the unclassified version on page 19. And it's the title conclusion, and it's the second paragraph. Even taken together, they list the five facts that counsel and I were just discussing. Even taken together, these facts do not convince the court by a preponderance of the evidence that Uthman received and executed orders from Al-Qaeda. He then goes on to say, certainly none of the facts respondents have demonstrated are true, are direct evidence of fighting or otherwise receiving and executing orders. Isn't it at least unclear as to whether the district court relied on the orders and fighting argument?
No, Your Honor, it's not unclear at all. And it would be error to skip what else exists in this paragraph.
All right.
It's not that the district court only considered whether Petitioner Uthman received and executed orders. He considered that as well as other independent bases, including whether or not the government had proved its major allegations that Uthman was a bodyguard or that Uthman was a frontline fighter. And the court goes on, we can't end at that point because the district court goes on and says that these facts, even together, do not paint an incriminating enough picture to prove by preponderance of the evidence that Petitioner Uthman was a member of Al-Qaeda.
But isn't the question, what does the court think? This is no bad reflection on the court. The law is not as developed at that point. But on page 2, he appears to explain what he believes to be the law on this subject, citing another district court, which has since been overruled, stating that the key question is whether an individual receives and executes orders from the enemy forces' combat apparatus.
But he doesn't say that's the only question.
He says it's the key question.
It may be an important question, and at that time it certainly was an important question, a key question, but not the only question. And what's important to note is that at the time, the Gharebi standard, the so-called Gharebi test, was actually a very functional test. because the petitioners in the district court at Garebi were arguing that the government had to prove that an individual had actually fought. That was their argument. And what Judge Walton said in Garebi was, no, you know, if you're transporting soldiers, if you're feeding soldiers, if you're serving a function, that's sufficient, and created this test. Now, it's important to note, too, that in this court, in this case, the district court said that there was no controlling law. So it's clear that Judge Kennedy was not applying any strict test or taking any formal approach. Well, and even when he quotes the Garebi test,
in the absence of controlling law, he's going to rely on the reasoning of the other judges.
Correct. And he notes, sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
And he notes, after citing the Garebi standard, that the scope of detention authority is as yet unresolved. He footnotes that immediately after citing Garebi. And he goes on, and you can see from the content of the opinion, from the plain language of the opinion, that he goes beyond the Garebi standard. He doesn't resolve the government's allegations by saying it's clear Uthman wasn't a bodyguard because there's no proof that he received and executed orders. The judge does not say it's clear that Uthman was not a frontline fighter because there's no evidence that he didn't that he received or executed orders. The judge considered the reliable evidence as a whole, and without applying some doctrinal idea that you have to demonstrate received and executed orders in order to resolve the case. Rather, the court below considered the evidence as a whole, and in his burden of proof section, section 1B, he makes very clear that the question that he's asking is whether the evidence as a whole demonstrates that petitioner Uthman is part of al-Qaeda.
You started by saying this is not a close case. The district court said in footnote 11 of the unclassified version that few, if any, non-combatants would have been in the vicinity during this time, quoting another document. If few, if any, non-combatants would have been in the vicinity at the time, isn't it more likely than not that your client was part of al-Qaeda, a combatant?
No, Your Honor. It is certainly the case under these facts.
Being in Tora Bora on December 15th of 2001, in the vicinity of Tora Bora?
That's not this case, Your Honor. There's no evidence that Petitioner Uthman was at Tora Bora. This is not al-Oda, where it's clear that he marched through Tora Bora. None of the individuals with whom Uthman was detained were carrying weapons. In fact, the government has only demonstrated...
Some of them were al-Qaeda.
Well, the government has demonstrated that a handful of 30-plus men were admitted later to being al-Qaeda members. And some of these...
Near Tora Bora,
In the vicinity. In the vicinity. And what's interesting here is that the court said, or there was evidence at the district court level that they were 12 miles away. But they were 12 miles away in a different country. There's unrebutted evidence. which was clearly the destination, at least certainly...
It's a little artificial.
What other mountains are there to go through?
Well, there are maps in the record, and the entire border, the sort of the eastern border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, has mountainous terrain.
The government's representation was that there was a flat paved road he could have taken, and that there's no explanation for not taking that road and instead going into the mountains. Well, is there an explanation?
Sure, there absolutely is an explanation, and this was an explanation that was offered at the district court level and that was considered by Judge Kennedy. And that explanation is that Petitioner Uthman was a young man trained to be a religious scholar who was teaching religion. He was a missionary. He did not speak the local language. He didn't know how to travel through Afghanistan. He had never been there. So he relied on his interpreter to provide him guidance. And when his interpreter said it's time to leave Afghanistan, he accepted his interpreter's advice and followed Afghani guides. If they had taken him directly out of Afghanistan via this road, that's the road he would have taken.
Well, other than following them, what explanation did you offer as to why the Afghani guides would have gone into the mountains rather than on the paved road?
There's evidence in the record that the Pakistanis at the time were being paid bounties by the United States government for turning over Arabs. And it's mere conjecture, and certainly it's not our burden to prove it, but it may very well be that these Afghanis understood that there was money waiting for them at the end of this road. And by collecting Arabs, who they handed over to the Pakistanis at the border, because there's evidence from another detainee that the Afghanis sent them over in small groups, and as these small groups crossed the borders, they were picked up immediately. So, there's evidence in the record that suggests that there was a plan being executed by these Afghani guides, potentially in cahoots with the Pakistani
border. If that were the plan, they'd go on the paved road directly into the arms of the waiting Pakistanis. Why did they go into the mountains?
Not if their goal was to pick up Arabs who are suspicious, who are hiding, who have other reasons to avoid the main roads. And at the time, Your Honor, the main roads were being targeted. At the time, the main roads were not necessarily safe for Arabs. So ultimately, in terms of Uthman's behavior, it's very clear that he was relying on the guidance given to him by his interpreter when he decided to follow the Afghani guidance.
Your position would mean, picking up on something I asked the government, that even if we were sitting here in January of 2002 or December of 2001, it would be improper for the military to detain people they captured in the vicinity of Tora Bora, which strikes me as a difficult position to maintain.
That's not this case, Your Honor. We're not in January of 2002. We're 10 years later.
Well, we have to analyze it as if we were, right?
And well, the question that we're asking
is there a floating standard that gets harder to meet for the government over time?
Well, it certainly would be the case that at the time, during active combat operations in a war zone, the standards for detention are going to be different.
Tora Bora was clearly a war zone.
And Petitioner Uthman was not at Tora Bora.
Right.
It's certainly the case that an Arab who is trying to leave Pakistan, who is unarmed, who's traveling in a group of unarmed men, only a handful of which identify themselves as al-Qaeda members, 9 years after being detained for 9 years, is certainly not subject to continued detention. That's our case.
Mm-hmm. You are placing some emphasis on the 9 years then.
We're placing emphasis on the fact that this is the merits hearing on his habeas petition. The courts have to be able to assess the actions of the executive and make a determination about whether their actions are reasonable. Would the assessment be different if it was a week after the detention? Probably so, but that's not the case here. The case
probably
here is
probably so. Why?
Because the facts are different. The opportunity of the executive to develop additional evidence is different. And the government has had 9 years to corroborate some of these allegations that they've been unable to corroborate. The government had an opportunity, in fact, 5 days of opportunity to present evidence to show that Petitioner Uthman was part of al-Qaeda. And this experienced trial judge, after assessing thousands of pages of exhibits and hearing
one of the problems, of course, though, is that the military and the court are dealing with uncertainty. The standard we have at most is the preponderance standard, which means there could be a chance, even a good chance, that what you're saying is correct. But is it more likely than not, given someone found in the vicinity of Tora Bora who traveled to Afghanistan on the same route as al-Qaeda fighters,
well,
who attended the institute in Yemen where other al-Qaeda were recruited?
And who's made numerous contradictory statements about a whole wide array of facts. How do you deal with that? We have case law that says that when we see those sorts of statements, it creates a strong inference against your client, right?
It's first, I'll address the travel route comment. Mm-hmm. And the simple response to the travel route comment is that anybody traveling from Yemen to Afghanistan at that time would have taken precisely the travel route that Petitioner Uthman took. Whether it's someone traveling for a wedding, whether it's a homemaker going to visit a friend.
Is that different from the cases where we said that could be part of the evidence against the person?
It is indeed, Your Honor.
So his path was different?
His path was different. There comes to be a point where others go on to training camps. We don't have that in this case. In this case, in fact, the judge found that there was no persuasive evidence that Petitioner Uthman ever attended.
The other case, that was an additional point in the other cases. I'm talking about geographically. Is there a difference in his route than in the other cases where we relied on that?
There are minor differences between the cases, but probably the most important differences here are that Petitioner Uthman traveled to Karachi the way that's typically done, paid for a hotel with his own money, took common carrier routes throughout all of his travel, traveled on public buses. When he ultimately arrived at his destination, he paid for a hotel there, and ultimately moved to Kabul and stayed with his employer. It's vastly different from the other cases where the travel route leads to a close association with al-Qaeda and actual conduct. In these other cases that demonstrates the individual's part of al-Qaeda. In this case, the government is unable to point to any particular function that Petitioner Uthman plays. They're not able to show what his part was, if he was a part of al-Qaeda at all. In fact, all they have is circumstantial evidence that he was among a handful of al-Qaeda members attempting to leave the war zone. So this case is very different.
What about the, respond to my question about the contradictory statements.
It's
how do you handle that?
It's not clear that Petitioner Uthman has given statements that are not consistent. I mean, he has told the same story, or he has given the same account throughout his 8 years of interrogation. And he's been so consistent, in fact, Your Honor, that a government interrogator...
How about the accounts of how he paid for his trip? He's been consistent on that?
Well, his explanation for the commenting on the individual who paid for his travel was that he was compelled to say that. And there's a wealth of information, including in this case, the detainees were compelled to make statements that were not true, something we may get into in a later session.
How about how he lost his passport? Inconsistent statements on it.
It's not an inconsistent statement to say, I don't know what happened to it. It's also reasonable that a religious missionary, who has been picked up and is being interrogated by the military and offered a variety of different interrogation techniques that are listed in many of the documents, trying to get him to make inculpatory statements, would, you know, do his best to describe what it was that happened to him. Petitioner Uthman doesn't know what happened to his passport. Perhaps he left it. Perhaps somebody took it. He doesn't know. All he knows is that the war was coming and he was trying to leave the country for his safety. And he has consistently stated that throughout the entire duration of his detention. And as to the payment issue, I think it's very important for this court to realize that Judge Kennedy never found that Petitioner Uthman lied. The word lie doesn't appear in the opinion. And when it comes to the apparent...
There are some things that were not quite believable, some words like that.
What Judge Kennedy said was that there are some aspects of Petitioner Uthman's account that are not entirely believable. But then he goes on to clarify, and he says that in particular, there is a questionable detail. And that detail was that Petitioner Uthman, a religious missionary, was able to teach in Afghanistan without speaking the local language. But there is evidence in the record provided by an expert on Yemen and on Arabic culture in general, who says it was pretty common. It was, in fact, very common for Yemeni men to travel to other parts.
What about his inability to remember the names of any of his students? We relied on that in another case. Even if they're in a different language, they still have names.
And here, Your Honor, we would urge the court to rely on the actual evidence and not on the characterizations of the government. Because while in one particular interrogation report, an interrogator might make a claim about what a detainee may or may not recall. It's clear from the evidence in this case that Petitioner Uthman knew the school that he went to in Kandahar. He describes who it was that was his employer when he was in Kabul and who he taught when he was in Kabul. He provides the names of his interpreter. And what's most interesting about this and very telling is that the government has never demonstrated a connection between any of these individuals and Al-Qaeda. The individuals who Uthman admits close association with during his time in Afghanistan have been in no way demonstrated by the government to be a part of Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda operatives, or in any way affiliated with
the 30 people with whom he was detained, the handful of which you said were Al-Qaeda, two of them said that they were Osama bin Laden's bodyguards. Is that right?
The allegation or the evidence from the government is that two admitted to being Al-Qaeda bodyguards.
So that's more than just being a member of Al-Qaeda. Doesn't that add significant weight to the... You're captured with Osama bin Laden's bodyguards, even in a group of 30. Is that... You think that's worth nothing?
Assuming the truth of that, I think we have to assume because they're based on interrogation reports, those are two individuals who Uthman did not claim to have known they were Al-Qaeda bodyguards. He didn't claim to have known what they were doing in Afghanistan.
He didn't know they were, but he did know them from the Furqan Institute, correct?
What the evidence shows is that these individuals, these various individuals, attended the Furqan Institute. They recognized or somehow discussed that fact when they met in Afghanistan. But the record is clear that none of the men knew that the others were in Afghanistan at the time. The record is very clear on that.
But leave that aside. Isn't it somewhat persuasive, whether it's beyond by itself a preponderance, that you're captured with people who were so trusted by Osama bin Laden that they served as his bodyguards?
Your Honor, it doesn't provide anything more than circumstantial evidence.
Well, everything. I would say in response to the question, Judge Griffith asked, is that all of our cases involve circumstantial evidence. We don't have a photo of anybody standing next to Osama bin Laden or blowing up the towers. So without that, we have only circumstantial evidence. That can't be the... We have said many times, of course, in criminal cases, circumstantial evidence is as good as any other kind of evidence. So
But when all that remains is circumstantial evidence, any reasonable hypothesis of
innocence... What would be better? What would be non-circumstantial evidence?
A detainee who reliably says, I was a bodyguard, that individual was a bodyguard, and we don't have that in this case.
Well, I thought the evidence is that they did say they were bodyguards.
The detainees claim to have been bodyguards themselves after interrogation, but there are no claims that Uthman himself was a bodyguard.
Oh, so if Uthman himself said he was a bodyguard, then we would have a non-circumstantial case.
I
of course,
think
we wouldn't have a habeas case then, would we?
The
reason we don't have any of those is because anybody who confesses to be part of Al-Qaeda, we're not going to see.
Well, I think there may still be cases because, as we've learned, there were some heavy-handed techniques used to extract some of this information from individuals.
But the judge carefully excluded the detainees where there's that allegation. These two, there was not that allegation, correct? The two who say they're bodyguards.
Did not allege that Uthman was among them. No, they didn't.
No, they don't allege that they were tortured or anything else.
We only have just the limited interrogation reports.
So do we.
But in this record, there's nothing in this record to suggest that.
So you say this is not a close case. If we thought it was a close case and that we're unclear about whether the district court applied the right rule, doesn't that call for at least a remand?
A remand is unnecessary in this case, Your Honor, because the government is only going to go back to the district court and provide the same evidence and ask the court to draw the same inferences
and apply the same
arguments.
So let me just point you to JA 269, which is the district court's opinion on, I think, reconsideration. It says, it acknowledges that respondents presented a case strong enough to make the decision a difficult one. The district court is not saying this is not a close case that I deal with easily. The district court is saying this is a difficult decision. And if there is some possibility from the language I read to you at the beginning that the court applied the wrong standard, why wouldn't we think that it's possible that in a case the court thought difficult, it might come out differently with a different standard?
What was difficult in this case, Your Honor, was not the legal standard to apply. What was difficult were the mountains of evidence and the mischaracterizations that were made at the district court level. It took 5 days for the district court to get through the government's evidence in this case because so much of what was presented turned out to be unreliable, turned out to be uncorroborated.
That's not what the district court says. He says presented a case strong enough, not irrelevant enough or confusing enough or too much stuff I don't really want to look at enough, just strong enough.
And what the district court also says is that at first blush, there are many incriminating facts.
That was in the previous
That's
opinion,
correct.
Right?
In the opinion on the merits, he says, at first blush, they're incriminating facts. But after close examination...
What he said in the first one, but I'm reading the second.
Right,
on reconsideration, he said, in considering the evidence, the court did find some incriminating facts.
But he also says in the motion on reconsideration, he says after careful consideration, the court concluded, as explained in the opinion, that the evidence did not sufficiently connect Uthman to Al-Qaeda.
I don't think there's any doubt that the court was careful. That's really, really not in dispute here. The question is whether the court applied the right test and whether the evidence, was... There are a number of points upon which the court didn't rule, that is, didn't make findings. Is that right?
I'm not sure that that's right, Your Honor. The court did make or include in a footnote a lengthy discussion regarding Petitioner Uthman's credibility. The court in a footnote provided lengthy discussion about the relevance of guest house evidence in this case. Really, those items that were called into question by the government in this case are resolved in the district court's opinion. And I would again urge the court to refer to the classified opinion, which is 8 pages longer and provides additional detail. But the court considered those things. This is not like Al-Adahi, where there's a piecemeal analysis, and ultimately the court doesn't take or examine the picture as a whole. This is not like Al-Adahi, where there are serious questions about credibility based on exculpatory explanations for meetings with bin Laden. And in Al-Adahi, they say the power of that evidence, of that false exculpatory statement, was the meeting with bin Laden. There's nothing even close to that in this case.
All right, we'll take your suggestion to discuss the classified material in a minute. Let's just give the opposing counsel, do you have anything left that you want to say in open court?
Yeah.
First of all, Your Honor, there is no evidence here of any bounty being paid. Uthman was traveling with six people that he says he was traveling with, that he identified. It was probably part of a group of 30, but he said that he was traveling with six. So we introduced evidence on those six. Now, four of those six went to the Furqan Institute, three of whom Uthman does say that he knew from the Furqan Institute. If you look at JA 628, he says Uthman, so there are some redactions here, but then whom Uthman knew from his school days. So that was the Furqan Institute. Now, one of those people we talked about, were they really bodyguards? Where this evidence come from? One of the two people who admitted to being bodyguards, he said he was very proud of being an Osama bin Laden guard.
Out of the six, were two of them bodyguards? Did two of them say they were bodyguards?
Two of them said they were bodyguards. Admitted that they fought with the Taliban. Another one said he trained at Al-Farouk and was at Tora Bora. And the fourth, there was evidence that he trained at Al-Qaeda training camps.
I count as that six.
The sixth trained at Al-Qaeda training camps. They also told a similar story about being teachers. One of them said that he created the story about being a teacher while they were escaping after he met up with his friends from the Furqan Institute, including Uthman. So this is very strong evidence that this, as one of the detainees put it, group of brothers was fleeing, as he said, or retreating from Tora Bora and other positions along the front lines. Now, I am happy to answer any questions in a closed session. In the view of the government, there isn't a need for a closed session, but.
Well, continue to take that position, even if we tell you now you lose without the closed session?
No, then I would like to talk about whatever you're worried about.
That was not a suggestion that that's true, but we'll give both sides an opportunity to present further evidence in the closed session. We'll take a break to set the court up for classified materials. Thank you.